Republic City Tribune Tower, Tribune Square. For just a second, Luo Qiang thought he'd dozed off in his office and was having that dream again. The one where the Wong girl was yelling his name. She was an irritating little creature in person, all full of airs and ideas that she was going to be a real reporter someday, and she had zero tolerance for old-fashioned newsroom paternalism. But in certain of Luo's dreams, she tended to be much more amenable to the traditional role of a junior reporter. Then he realized that he was not, in fact, asleep at his desk, and furthermore that Wong's voice seemed to be coming from behind him. Which was a bit puzzling, since the only thing behind him was his office window, and his office was on the 21st floor. He swiveled in his chair, and then stared in amazement at the sight of Emily Wong, standing with a face like thunder about 10 feet from the window, as though the office were at street level, and she stood on the sidewalk. Startled, he bolted from his chair and threw open the window. Leaning out, he saw that Emily had not, in fact, somehow learned how to fly, but, very nearly as astonishingly, was standing on the back of an Air Nomad Sky Bison, whose master was keeping it in a very steady hover just below the window. "Wong, what in the world?" he began, but Emily cut him off. Fists clenched and arms akimbo, face nearly crimson with rage, she bellowed in a voice that could be heard plainly out in the bullpen. "You imbecile! What in the world possessed you to libel the Avatar in an article with my name on it?" For a moment, Luo was so taken aback he couldn't even react. Then, with the fury of his own rising, he leaned out the window and shouted back, "Who the hell do you think you are, Wong? I haven't seen your cute little butt in the bullpen all day, and then you show up taking that tone with me?" Drawing himself up in a slightly futile effort to assert his authority over someone who was shouting at him from the sky outside his window, he added lamely, "You're lucky I don't fire you." Emily snorted, sneering at him, all the disdain and resentment she felt at having spent 2 years as this patronizing creature's lackey boiling up at once. "You can't fire me," she shot back. "You don't have the balls to fire me. I'm the only thing standing between you and the entire White Lotus legal team, you pusillanimous sack of talentless mung." Pointing toward his chair with an imperious finger, she went on, "Now you sit there and you think about what you did. I'll be back to clean up your mess when I'm friggin' good and ready. And if you know what's good for you, you'll stay out of my way while I'm doing it." Then, turning away, she sat down behind the low wall at the front of the bison's saddle and gave it a couple of thumps with her hand. Not very convincingly hiding a smile under an impassive front, the skinny Air Nomad youth at the controls twitched the reins and guided the animal away from the building. As soon as they were a reasonable distance from the Tribune building, which didn't take long at Vayu's cruising speed, Nima glanced back over her shoulder with a grin and said, "That was nicely done." "I feel so much better," said Emily, sagging wearily against the prow of Vayu's saddle. "Okay, now I can sleep." She told Nima her address, but by the time they arrived, she was already out like a light. She would always wonder thereafter how the spindly young Air Nomad had gotten her up to her fourth floor walk-up apartment and into her bed. Air Temple Island. "Well, that must have gone well," Minami Sato announced, striding into the sun parlor once the reporter had left the house. "Yeah, the walls are still vertical, and I didn't see Miss Wong launched into the harbor," Ryo added, carrying a small basket with him as he followed his sister in. "I still remember that one time when we were at that joint meeting," he continued, looking over at Cora. Cora, for her part, hadn't reacted to the sibling's words. She was standing by one of the open, east-facing windows, watching the buff-colored form of Vayu receding toward the city skyline as Nima ran Emily home. Once the bison was out of view, Cora's broad shoulders sagged, and she turned and flung herself back into the chair she had been occupying with a great sigh. Four things never change. Death, taxes, the spirits, and the rumor mill. Cora grumbled as she looked up at the ceiling, not addressing anybody in particular. There were murmurs of agreement from those assembled, especially from Rio and Minami. Since Kate had taken the chair Emily had vacated, the Satos found the chairs full and the futon daybed arguably overfull, since it had Annabelle, all three of her parents, and her dragon on it. So they seated themselves at opposite ends of the sofa which stood along the wall. Still, it could have been worse. Much worse. Cora let out a self-deprecating chuckle as she lowered her gaze from the ceiling to her friends. The media's come up with some whoppers, particularly back in the day. Oh? Do tell, Kate said with her impish smile. Cora rolled her eyes in a sidelong glance at the samurai. Well, since you asked so nicely. She reached back with her arms, hands interlaced, stretching her body briefly before settling back down into a more relaxed slouch. As you can imagine, with a job like mine, in the public eye all the time, there have been all sorts of contradictory theories as to who I was with at any given time, even if the actual concrete evidence was right there in front of them. Right from the start of my public career, I mean, you take my original team, Mako, Bolin, Asami, any of them at any one time, or all three of them at once, which, if nothing else, I have to take as a vote of confidence in my stamina. Oh, don't give me that shocked look, Minami. I might be a girl, but your great-great-grandmother was very attractive. I had quite a bit of adjustment getting used to that, let me tell you, she added, reddening slightly with a smile. Nothing in my woefully limited experience of the world up to then had prepared me for Asami Sato blowing into my life. She grinned at Minami's blushing, startled look and Ryo's brief, dumbfounded expression. Hey, Asami had no shortage of suitors. You have to accept that, at least. Do I have to explain the spirokeets and the bumbleflies to you again? Ryo shook his head. No, no, we're good. Cora chuckled. Good. Anyway, that was just the tip of the iceberg. Pretty much anybody I've spent any significant time with, in some fashion, I've been paired with romantically in the press. Even some of my enemies, weirdly enough. Opponents in the pro-bending ring, various people I've butted heads with out in the field. I never understood that. I mean, come on, Tano? I had to touch that guy to give him his bending back, and afterwards I just wanted to go and wash my hands for an hour. She looked around at a small sea of puzzled faces. You have no idea what I'm talking about now. Okay, moving on. It was mostly my friends, anyway. Bending teammates, colleagues from Project Phoenix Flight or the White Lotus. Even Aang didn't have to put up with so much commentary on his social life. She sighed and made a what-can-you-do-with-this gesture. And that was just the fanzines and stuff like Section 4. It only got worse when TV and computers started really taking off. That was about when the White Lotus finally got their act together and made a media division to handle all of it. So that's why Chiang's a Master Lotus, Caitlin mused. Well, yeah. He's not my first press agent. That position's been around for nearly a century now. They certainly managed to reduce the number of embarrassing pictures I was in. Spirits, that one of me and President Raiko back in 171. Cora shook her head at an awkward memory. It can't have been easy for them, especially once you got to the ubiquitous electronic media stage, Utrina commented. Harder to get people to throttle back by talking with them, like we just managed to do with Emily there. Oh yeah, Cora nodded. For instance, back in 193, that's what? 2312 to you. Agni, almost 100 years ago, she said, pausing for a second to fathom that. Then, shaking herself slightly, she went on, I backseated for Asami in the Future City Historic GP, the first one. And for weeks afterwards, this one guy on the Avatar Spotters BBS, no lightning web yet, remember, was obsessed with the crypto-lesbian subtext. With a faint smirk, she added, Guy was really reading into the Winner's Circle champagne thing, if you know what I'm saying. Yeah, I've seen the pictures at the Sato Museum. Corwin commented, waggling his eyebrows suggestively. Cora rolled her eyes and gently punched his shoulder, unable to entirely suppress a smile. Pervert. Cora shrugged. You guys looked awesome together, he said mildly. I don't see how digging that is perverted. Minami opened her mouth, trying to think of something to say. That's... Well, Ryo finished for her, equally at a loss for words. Cora nodded sagely to the Satos. People will think the craziest things, I know. I've just had to get used to it. Ah, you know what it's like, right? We do indeed, answered the voice of Master Rohan, standing at the doorway. Behind him could be seen Milo, with two lemurs on his shoulders. Good afternoon, everyone. Lady Anthe, I do hope the discussion with Miss Wong did not upset little Annabelle. Oh no, not at all, replied Anthe with a smile. She seemed to be quite taken with her. Nobody cares if I was upset. Oh no, Garnet mumbled. My apologies, Mistress Garnet. Rohan replied, making the airbender salute toward the dragonette. I did not wish to distract you from your duties. Mollified, Garnet nestled back against Annabelle's shoulder. Fine. Just see that it doesn't happen again. Rohan nodded graciously. Of course not, my lady. My lady. I like that. Can we keep him? The dragon murmured to Anthe, drawing a chuckle from her and Utrina. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he's already taken, Utrina commented with a thoughtful look toward the airbending master. That would be a correct assumption, Prince Utrina, Rohan replied, unperturbed. But I'll let my wife know that her good taste is appreciated. Speaking of which, I believe there's somebody else who would like to meet the newest member of the family. Isn't that right, Makoto? Milo announced as he moved his way past his younger brother. And a pleasant and delightful afternoon to you all as well. He continued as he made the airbender salute and bowed, allowing Makoto the lemur to take off from his perch and sail over to Anthea's shoulder. Meanwhile, the other lemur, a gray-furred, ring-tailed specimen, absently picked crumbs from Milo's beard. Thanks, Master Milo, Utrina replied as she watched Garnet and Makoto eyeing each other from their respective positions. It's definitely been different. Also, Cora, I couldn't help overhearing the subject of your discussion from earlier about your colleagues, Milo went on. What would my romantic chances be, perchance? Cora rolled her eyes with a put-upon expression. I changed your diapers, Milo. That's an automatic disqualification. Milo did not appear dismayed by this blatant dismissal. He just shrugged and replied with an amused smile, Oh well, maybe in another 20 years. In another 20 years, we'll be back where we started, Cora muttered, almost inaudibly. Spirits, I did not need that image, Minami said with an exaggerated twitch, which her brother mirrored. Rohan coughed and raised his voice. Be that as it may, he said, trying to get the conversation back on track, I have been in discussion with Jinora about your plan to establish a homestead within the borders of the United Republic, and I believe we have a potential solution for you. Wait, you're planning on moving here? Minami asked, her previous discomfiture forgotten. Why didn't you tell us earlier? Not full-time, but yeah, we're looking into building a home in the Republic. We just figured it out ourselves this morning, Corman admitted. And it might still be a little early to be using words as generous as plan. Hell, son, if we'd known, we'd have gladly given you the back 40 on the ranch, Rio added. It's got a lake, you know. Corwin laughed. Thanks, Rio. I appreciate it, I really do. But I think we want something a little closer to Republic City. Anyway, we can dig into it more later on. He smiled, looking over at Anthy and Annabelle, who were watching the stare-off between Garnet and Makoto. Finally, the Dragonette apparently judged the lemur no threat and moved aside so that Makoto could approach his mistress's daughter. All right, you can pass, but no funny business. Garnet, it'll be all right, believe me, Anthy said with a smile. Makoto, this is Annabelle. Annabelle? Makoto. Lemur eyes met baby eyes for several moments, and then with a chitter, Makoto turned around and scampered over Utena's lap to reach the fruit bowl that had been placed on the end table there, retrieving one of the fruits within. He then darted back to his place next to Anthy and tried to offer the fruit to Annabelle. Oh, that's very thoughtful of you, Makoto, Anthy said with a gently reproachful smile as she guided the lemur's paws away from her daughter's face. But please don't take offense. Annabelle doesn't want that right now. The lemur let out a puzzled chirp, looking around in confusion. Corwin grinned and reached out his hand. Hey, I do. Is that a lychee? All right, he said as he accepted the offered fruit and peeled it. Caitlin let out a thoughtful hum and looked over at the avatar. Cora, do you still have those pictures? I'm curious. What? Yeah, on my laptop, ironically enough, said Cora with a wink, thinking of Emily's recently declared distrust of digital photo archiving. It's in my room. Let me go get it, she added, starting to get out of her chair. Milo stopped her with a raised hand. Oh, no need to get up, my love. Let me handle it. With that, the aged master pulled out a small cylindrical whistle from beneath his robes and blew three sharp notes on it. Immediately, the lemur on his shoulder came to attention, and three other flying lemurs soared in from the open sunroom windows and perched on his other shoulder and his outstretched arms. Good, good. Poki, Tosa, Ogo, Limu, if you would be so kind, he said, and then trailed off into a series of chittering, clicking, chirps, and whistles. The four lemurs appeared to take this on board, and as one they leapt off Milo's robes and soared back out the window, in such a hurry that they didn't even seem to notice there had been a tiger in the room the entire time. Gonna be honest, that was a little disturbing, Rio stated. It is not for nothing that Milo is called the Master of Lemurs, Rohan stated gravely. Father always wondered what he had unleashed upon the world when he taught my brother how to train them. Well, I think it's charming, Anthy replied. Isn't that right, Makoto? Prrrt, replied the lemur. She's got you there, Rohan, Cora remarked with a smile. Yes, Rohan muttered. In any case, if you wish, I can take you and your family out to see the sight tomorrow, Corwin. Sounds great, Corwin replied. Let's all go. Actually, I'm afraid I'll have to pass, Corwin. I need to meet with Eitaro tomorrow and let him know we're bringing Emily on board for the comet case, Cora explained. And I think Junie-chan and I will be spending most of our last day in town at the Zuko Academy, Caitlin added, so that she can show Master Ito and me just how much she's improved in, gosh, a little under a week? Time flies, doesn't it? Cora asked with a grin. Aw, said Corwin disappointedly. I'd love to go, but I'm afraid I just can't, Minami said ruefully. I'm already skiving off work today. Ryo can go, though, she added brightly. His office is just for show anyway. My loving sister, ladies and gentlemen, said Ryo cheerfully. But no, really, love to. I can help you size up the site. With a sarcastic look at Minami, he added, I do have a little experience in the building trades. Sure, glad to have the help. Corwin smiled at Anthy and their daughter. Annabelle's first big day out. Utrina chuckled slightly. Man, the poor kid's going to be all tired out, and she was just born less than 24 hours ago. Cora looked like she was about to say something, but at that moment the four winged lemurs returned through the open window, carrying a pillowcase with a blocky item slung within it, grasped by the open end and their lower paws. Ha! Not bad! Cora exclaimed, catching the bundle as the lemurs dropped the cloth-wrapped laptop in her hands. Good work, you four. Have some fruit, she said, gesturing toward the fruit bowl before she extracted her cabbage computer's laptop from within the pillowcase. The lemurs thought this a fine suggestion and scampered over to the fruit bowl, ignoring the protests from Garnet in the process. Once they ate their fill, they chittered and squeaked at Makoto as they exited out the window, all save the first ring-tailed lemur, who glided back to Milo's shoulder to resume his station. Very good, Pokey. Here, have another, Milo said as he produced a lychee from a pouch beneath his robes and offered it to the lemur. All right, Cora said as she pulled her armchair closer to the futon, setting the open laptop on the sheets so that those assembled could get a better view. Gather round, kids. It's Avatar story time. Caitlin adjusted her chair as well, while Minami and Ryo got up and moved to the edge of the futon so they could have a better view without crowding those already on it. Hey, don't go yet, Cora said to the two airbending masters, as she brought up her photo application and started scrolling through the images. Ha! She grinned and turned the laptop so that the two taller men could see the screen clearly. Brings back memories, eh, Rohan? Utrina leaned over to take a look at the picture in question. It was faded and sepia-toned, depicting a tall, stern, bald, airbending master in his formal robes, standing next to a younger woman in air acolyte robes with gray streaks in her hair, clearly his wife. In front of them stood three children. The eldest two were girls, the youngest a boy no older than six, his head shaved bald. The mother of the three held a bundle in her arms, a tiny baby boy, capped with a short ruff of dark hair.
That is one happy-looking family, Milo remarked appreciatively.
Hey, not bad, Utrina remarked, and then looked up at Rohan. Why'd you get rid of the beard? Cora blinked.
No, that's Master Tenzin, she said, pointing at the senatorial figure, then moving her fingertip to the baby in the wife's arms. That's Rohan, the one with the hair. Cora smiled up at Rohan, who coughed and stroked his chin, trying and failing to look unperturbed.
Oh, wow, Caitlin observed. This is a while back.
Yeah, once digital media really started getting prevalent, I raided all the attics and storage places I could to get all our old photos scanned. I've got quite a few of them from back in the day.
Seems like a lot of work, said Garnet.
Well, it's either that or else I haul out about 35 3-inch thick photo albums just to show off some of my pictures. As it is, most of them are stored in the preservation vaults at the Avatar Museum. I've only kept the most recent albums here. And your diligence in preserving our history is most appreciated, Cora, Rohan added, before directing a bow towards the assemblage. But for now, we should go inform Jinora of your plans for tomorrow. Cool. Thanks, Master Rohan, Utrina replied. We'll see you in the morning?
Of course, Prince Tenjo, added Milo. Come along, Pokey. Let the poor tiger have some rest, hmm?
The ring-tailed lemur, which seemed to have decided to play with Sergei's ears for a bit, with a much-put-upon look from the Neo-Tiger, chirruped and returned to the aged master's shoulder. Then Milo and his younger brother exited the room. Cora waved as the two airbenders left, then returned her focus to her laptop. Shuffling through the pictures, she flipped through them in rapid succession, until another photo caught her eye. Now this is an old one, she said with a smile. This has to be in the top 10 or so oldest photos I have. The picture in question was another black and white shot, nearly square, and though its blacks had faded to brown with age, it was surprisingly sharp for its evident vintage. It had apparently been taken under very good light conditions. Neatly framed against a backdrop of wind-sculpted snowdrifts, it contained two figures. One was a teenage girl it took the onlookers a few moments to recognize as Cora, aged about 13. Smaller and skinnier than she would grow to be just a few years later, more wiry than buff, but with the same signature hairstyle and the same unmistakable grin. She was sprawled on her back in the snow, arms outstretched as if preparing to make a snow angel. Most of her body was obscured by the second figure, the great hulking shape of an empty saddled polar bear dog, lying full length on the ground with her back legs extended and her powerful forelegs folded at her sides. Her massive block of a head rested on, and indeed almost completely hid, Cora's torso, with her nose nearly touching the girl's chin. "Aw," said Corwin. Shinti-san, Shieryue 9, 166, ASC. Wednesday, December 9th, Standard Year 2285. The South Pole. Cora fastened the last of the straps, performed a careful walk around to double-check that everything was secure, and nodded with satisfaction at her handiwork.
"Well, girl, what do you think?" she asked. "Shall we see if it works?"
Naga eyed her dubiously before casting a wary glance back over her shoulder at the strange contraption her young friend had just affixed to her back. She gave herself a shake, causing said contraption to rattle and jingle, then turned back to Cora, still looking very unconvinced.
"Oh, come on, you big baby, it'll be fun," Cora said, reaching up to pet the broad expanse of the polar bear dog's forehead.
Naga sighed, her ears drooping with resignation, but Cora just laughed, put her foot into the near side stirrup, and swung herself aboard. The maneuver was a little clumsy. She'd practiced it a few times with the saddle affixed to a railing, and the experience was not really the same, but effective, and she figured she'd get the hang of it soon enough. She reached down and rubbed Naga's withers with the palm of a hand, then took up the reins and said, "All right, Naga, let's go." With a sound that might almost have been a grumble, Naga set off out of the storage building where Cora had prepared her surprise. Outside, it was a glorious summer day, clear and bright with nary a cloud in the sky, and Cora's spirits, already high with optimism about her new experiment, lifted further once they were out in it. They took it slowly at first, walking around the little courtyard between the storage area and the living quarters, each of them getting the feel of the new arrangement. Cora had ridden other animals before, of course. You didn't grow up in the South Pole without learning how to stay on an Arctic camel at an early age, but Naga's gait was completely different from theirs. At walking pace, her broad back rose and fell a lot more than a camel's, and there was a curious roll to her movement that took a bit of anticipating to ride smoothly. After only a couple of laps of the courtyard, Cora knew her thighs were going to be aching at the end of this test ride, the muscles there having been worked in new and unfamiliar ways, but that was all right. Part of the learning process. It would be no worse than learning that one earthbending stance had been, and she got through that all right. After a few more minutes, Naga paused and looked back over her shoulder as if to ask, "Can we be done now?" Cora grinned at the sight. "Getting bored, girl?" she asked. "Well, this has gone pretty well so far. I guess we can take it up a notch." With a wiggle of her hips to make sure she was fully seated, she twitched the reins in her hands lightly and made a clicking sound with her tongue. Naga's response to this was not to break into a trot, which had been Cora's intention, but to stop altogether. Looking quizzical, Cora tried it again, receiving no evident response. Naga didn't seem to be paying any attention to her at all. The dog lowered her head and shoulders, her front legs bent, giant forepaws flexing in the snow like hands. "Naga?" Cora wondered, leaning forward. "What's the matter? I thought you wanted to go..." With an explosive burst of energy that nearly left her rider behind, Naga suddenly lunged forward, going from a standing start to a run in a second, and skipping over anything as weedy as a trot altogether. Clods of snow flew in her wake as her great claws dug into the ground for maximum purchase. "Faster!" Cora finished, seizing the saddle's pommel to keep her seat. "Whoa! Naga, whoa! What's gotten into you?" At this rate, they would reach the courtyard fence in seconds. Cora shifted her weight, rebalancing herself, and took up the reins again, thankful that she'd had the foresight to route them through loops at the front of the saddle so they couldn't fall to the ground if she let go of them. They weren't much more than handholds themselves, truth to tell. She hadn't wanted to put a bit or some similar arrangement in Naga's mouth as one would with a camel. Her teeth weren't suited for that kind of thing, and besides, the principle had always struck Cora as rather cruel. Instead, the reins were attached to part of the rigging that encircled Naga's neck, so that pulling on them would exert mild pressure there. They weren't meant to control the dog so much as make suggestions. And it appeared that Naga wasn't really interested in taking suggestions just at the moment. What she was interested in, apparently, was jumping over the fence and heading for the White Lotus compound's main gate. For all that Cora had been thinking for years at this point about how great it would be to stage an escape, she hadn't really been planning on it today. And so it was with more than slight alarm that she realized that was where Naga was heading. Not so much riding as hanging on at this point, she was coming almost completely out of the saddle at the peak of each stride and then jouncing uncomfortably back down again at the bottom. In this condition, she couldn't really see the dumbfounded White Lotus guards in their towers at either side of the gate, but she knew they must be there. "Sorry," she shouted, doing her best to wave without letting go of anything. "We're not going far, I hope." Shouts of consternation came from above, and then, to Cora's distinct dismay, the gate started closing. At the rate Naga was going, they wouldn't clear it in time, and plowing at speed into an iron-banded wooden stockade gate was really not on Cora's to-do list today. "Naga, stop!" she cried, tugging uselessly on the reins. And all at once a profound sense of peace settled over her as she realized what they had to do. She stopped fighting, stopped worrying, and just let the moment happen. Settling into the rhythm of the dog's strides, she leaned low over Naga's back, feeling the muscles of the dog's massive shoulders bunch and release under her hands, and smiled. "Okay, girl," she murmured. "You want to run? Let's run." With the abatement of all resistance from the wheelhouse, Naga seemed to sink lower to the ground, her strides lengthening further as she put everything she had into a headlong charge for the gate. "Come on, Naga," Cora exhorted her, all but flattening herself against the dog's back. "Come on, girl. Let's see what you've got." For just an instant, as they barreled inexorably for the still-closing gate, Cora feared that she'd left it too late and they'd be caught in the closing doors. She'd almost made up her mind to do something involving waterbending and the snow on the ground to try and jam the hinges, though at this speed that had precious little chance of working, before she saw that it wouldn't be necessary. Grinning fiercely, she settled down again, her body moving in perfect time with her mounts now, and they shot out into the open countryside beyond the compound like a bolt from a crossbow.
"Yeah!"
Cora cried, pumping a fist in triumph.
"Woo!"
With the immediate goal achieved, Naga showed no sign of slowing down, galloping at full pelt across the open snowfield in front of the compound. At the back of her head, Cora wondered how far they were going to go, but at this point she no longer really cared. She was too caught up in the rush of sensations, the tremendous power of this incredible animal, the wondrous cold sting of the slipstream on her face, the utterly profound revelation that here was freedom of a kind she'd never tasted before. Transported with joy, she raised both fists above her head, sitting fully upright in the saddle, then opened them to let her fingers catch the wind. And Naga stopped.
"Wah!"
Cora declared, somersaulting over the dog's head. Her reflexes were so well trained, and the untouched snow out here was sufficiently soft, that she was in no danger of injury, but she was momentarily stunned as she landed flat on her back in a drift, disappearing in a cloud of powder. Barking happily, Naga ran past her, then made a great paddling turn in the soft snow and raced back to stand over her, wagging and panting, the picture of urso-canine delight. Cora sat partway up, brushing snow out of her face, and tried to give Naga a censorious look, but she was still flushed with excitement from the ride and couldn't keep the grin off her face, which rather ruined the attempt.
"You did that on purpose," she accused the dog.
Naga barked again, as if to admit it, then battered at the snow with one huge forepaw, sending a new wave of it cascading over Cora's face.
"Ah! Pfft!"
Cora cried, spitting snow and waving blindly with one hand while trying to cover her face with the other. Naga's response to this was to repeat the gesture with the opposite paw, dousing her from the other side.
"Gah! Bad dog! Such a bad dog!"
Naga growled and struck a playful bow, hindquarters up and wagging, shoulders hunched, head low, sounding as though she were about to savage and devour her human friend. She waved her great head from side to side so as to slap Cora's face with her hanging ears.
"Murder!"
laughed Cora, fending her ineffectually off.
"Somebody help! She's gone rogue! Oh, spirits, is this how it ends? Polar bear dog and waterbender, enemies again? Oof!"
The last was occasioned as Naga, tiring of the game, took another step forward and then basically collapsed, pinning Cora's legs under her chest and resting her enormous head on the young water tribeswoman's body. Only Cora's head, shoulders, and arms were still visible. All the rest was covered by the vast bulk of her companion. She reached up with one hand and made a half-hearted, completely unsuccessful attempt to push the contented dog's head off her chest, then let her arms flop helplessly out to the sides.
"Oh, I am killed,"
Cora declared weakly. From somewhere off to one side came a soft mechanical click, and then a familiar voice declared with audible amusement, "I can see that." Cora turned her head to see her mother a short distance away astride an Arctic camel, a small box camera in her hand. "I guess I picked a good day to come and visit," said Senna, taking another picture. "Yeah," Cora agreed sentimentally. "That was a good day." She gazed at the photo of herself and her first friend for a few moments longer, then shook off the reverie and went back to flicking through the thumbnails.
"Oh, hey, here's a good one," she said after a few moments,
pausing and enlarging her next choice so that everybody could see it. Mom and Dad, their 25th wedding anniversary. I took time off from college to celebrate with them. I just started that year. She chuckled fondly, her eyes misting up a little. Spirits. If I didn't have a normal childhood, I'd at least have a normal college experience. Such a thing exists? News to me. Caitlin quipped with a wink. Gathering around, the group could see what looked to be the interior of some sort of longhouse, decorated with Arctic items and the emblems of the water tribe. Front and center was the couple in question, both clad in polar finery that called to mind the dress Cora had worn at Utina and Corwin's wedding. The woman bore a striking resemblance to Cora, save for the laugh lines on her face and the fact that her hair was pulled forward over her shoulders into two long tails, kept in place by thin ties. She was dwarfed by the man standing next to and a little behind her, her head barely reaching past his goateed chin. His face was craggy, the very square jaw. He was built like a linebacker, and he had a hand on the woman's shoulder while she leaned against him, both of them obviously in love with one another. "Is it weird if I say your mom was a good-looking lady?" Rio wondered. Cora snorted. "A little," she said. "But thank you, Rio. She'd be pleased you think so." "Dad, not so much," she added wryly. "But then he had his own fans, so it evens out." Grinning, Kate put up a hand. "Yes, please." "Somehow I figured. But oh, here's a good one for the rest of us. This was back in 177, 2296 for you galactic people. The Recovery Coordination Aid Station in the courtyard of Gaoling's town hall after the earthquake." With that, Cora brought up another picture. Utina was immediately reminded of the outside of Tau City's government house. It had the same amount of discord and debris from a major disaster, the same degree of hope at rebuilding. Rescue workers could be seen in the background, as well as a large, bulky machine that Utina realized was a mecha builder. But the primary focus was on the two young men in the foreground, who had gathered at a water station to refresh themselves. They were both caught in the act of looking toward the camera, disheveled yet proud, and smiling at the photographer as they realized who was taking the picture. They were different in build and height and state of dress, but they had that intangible quality that marked them as brothers. The shorter of the two was stocky, his hair and features more rounded than the other's. The muscles of his brawny arms, chest, and abdomen were easily revealed by the construction vest he wore with no shirt underneath, and he radiated a solid bonhomie. Even filthy and sweat-streaked, his eyes dark-rimmed with fatigue, he was grinning broadly and giving a high sign with the hand not holding a paper cone of water. The taller one was leaner in build and face, very fit, but more like a runner than a boxer. He, too, was smudged from a day's hard work and wearing a soot-smeared outfit that Utina took a moment to realize was an archaic Republic City police uniform, modern versions of which she'd seen earlier in the week. He was weary-looking and appeared more reserved in general, yet his smile lit up his face, which looked as if he didn't know exactly what to do with it when that occurred. "My boys," said Cora cheerily, "the fabulous Bending brothers, Bolin," she pointed, "and Mako. To be Sergeant Mako very soon after this picture was taken, if I recall correctly." At the sight of him, Benami's eyes lit up, and she pointed out the taller figure. "So that's the famous Mako, Cora? I do love a man in uniform." Cora chuckled. "You're not alone in that, Benami." Garnet peered over Annabelle's head and said judiciously, "The one with the eyebrows? He's pretty, but the other fellow looks more dependable. Or at least sturdier." "Well, of course," Cora pointed out. "Bolin's an earthbender. Mako's the firebender in that team. He's the one who taught me how to lightning bend, among other things." "Eh," said Garnet, unpersuaded. "That's all very well, but I can set stuff on fire myself. I don't need the help to be able to do that. she added pragmatically. Then, with a wry little dragon grin, she added, I'd keep that one around to oil my scales, mind, but the short one's clearly the more useful minion. And the room broke up in a laugh. Anyway, Asami's also there, in the Mecha Builder. In case you were curious, never let it be said that the CEO of Future Industries was afraid to get her hands dirty. Korra smiled at Minami. A sentiment that's definitely shared by her heir, Ryo added with a grin, avoiding a swat by his older sister. Korra laughed and flipped through more pictures before settling on another one. It was a wide-angle shot so as to get a frankly gigantic Avatar Yangchen statue in frame. Down below, by the statue's folded legs, they could see a row of figures, all of them in meditative postures. Master Tenzin, Korra, recognizably younger Jinora, Iki, Milo, and a 5-year-old-looking Rohan. The second time we took the Air Temples trip, when civil war wasn't raging in the Water Tribes, and the world wasn't about to end, Korra explained. The first one was rather rushed, as you might imagine. The Satos, Caitlin, and Corwin nodded sympathetically, while Utina gave her husband a curious look. Later, he murmured, and she nodded in response. Another during my later college days, Korra went on, flipping to another photograph. We'd pretty much gotten into a routine at that time, but Asami needed to get away from the office for a few months, and, well... She enlarged the tinted picture, which showed a grinning Korra in her signature clothes, wearing a blue bowl helmet and raised goggles, shielding her eyes as she looked off towards an out-of-shot horizon in the pink glow of a late summer afternoon. Behind her a little ways was another woman, fair-skinned and gorgeous, with long dark hair that very much resembled Minami's. Tall and slim, elegant even in rumpled cycling leathers, she stood next to a sturdy-looking motor scooter, looking back the other way with a curious expression. In the far distance behind them was a tall rectangular tower with the blocky solidity of the Earth Kingdom about it. Spirits, that is great-great-grandmama Sami, Ryo breathed while Minami stared. That's her scooter, Minami added. When was this? Ryo asked. Summer vacation during college, a couple years before I started my master's. 179, I think? Yeah, that's about right, Korra said, checking the timestamps on the photo. Or 2298 for you guys. The kind of world trip an Avatar's supposed to have. Making up for lost time. Was this the entire world? Uchina asked. Well, not the world. Too much going on for me to get it all done in one go. This one was most of a lap of the Earth Kingdom, which was almost like traveling the whole world. Korra grinned. We managed to get the boys to tag along for legs of it, and Jinora, who was hitting the nomad phase of air nomad life at that time, I'm pretty sure she took this photo, accompanied us on her way to the Eastern Air Temple, but for the most part it was just the two of us girls on the road. She let out a satisfied sigh. Ah, good times. More pictures flicked by in succession, before settling on one of Korra in a rather silly-looking voluminous robe and a flat hat, shaking the hand of an educated-looking man as he handed her a rolled-up piece of parchment. Korra grinned with pride. And they said it couldn't be done, she remarked. First Avatar with a modern-day advanced degree. She flipped to another picture and laughed. In it, herself, Mako, Bolin, and Asami could be seen in the middle of what had to be the Avatar's graduation party. Iki and Milo, now both young adults, could be seen in the background, chatting up other people. The expressions on the four could only be summed up as ranging from amusement to puzzlement, as an older man, with truly impressive sideburns and a serious mien, appeared to be lecturing Korra. I'll never forget Professor Protester showing up at my graduation party. He looked me in the eye and said, "Let's get something straight, Avatar. I don't like you. You're a pampered, privileged elitist who exists to perpetuate an antiquated and oppressive world system. But you're not ashamed of it, and you work hard. I respect you for that. I've never been more lovingly insulted. Still makes me feel warm inside. She switched to the next image in the stack, laughed, and said, "Here's another one for Mom's fans." Utina was vaguely surprised to recognize this photo's setting as the front straight at Future Industries Raceway Park. The grandstand had obviously been rebuilt or replaced since it was taken, but it was in the same place, and the striped curbs were the same. In the foreground, slightly motion-blurred, the photographer had caught an old-fashioned racing Sato-mobile, like the one Utina had seen on her own visit to the track, just in the moment it flashed past the infield camera. Two jacketed, helmeted, goggled figures hunched in the tandem seats, the one at the wheel grinning fiercely, the one in back with gleeful fist upraised. The figure in back was unmistakably Asami Sato, looking very much like her descendant Minami did in racing trim. For a second, Utina assumed the one in front was Cora, until she realized that she couldn't be, because Cora was in the grandstand, her hands cupped around her mouth as an improvised megaphone, cheering. Beside her towered her father, slightly out of place in formal dress. In contrast to his daughter's broad, delighted grin, his expression was harder to place, a curious and amusing combination of pleasure, pride, enthusiasm, and dismay. I would just like to note for the record that the first time Asami took me out in a Sato-mobile, she drove, said Cora dryly as it dawned on her audience who the woman in the front seat must be. My reverence for your sainted mother increases apace, said Ryo with a grave, seated bow. Cora chuckled. She was pretty great, she agreed. This was that same weekend when they were in town for my graduation. With a sentimental smile, she added, Dad grumbled about it for the rest of his life. That woman's gone and turned my Senna into an adventurer. One of those in this family was enough. At Anthea's slightly arched eyebrow, Cora grinned and said, That was just Chief Tonrock playing to the stereotypes. He loved it. Some women in their 40s get depressed. Mom? She clicked to another picture. Mom did stuff like this. In this case, stuff like this involved standing in front of a large twin-engine seaplane at a dock in what looked like the harbor of a major city, dressed in classically styled aviator gear and beaming. Next to her stood a tall, ornately dressed man who appeared to be trying to hide a look of dread, and a serious-looking, bespectacled, middle-aged woman who was almost swamped by the enormous military-style parka she wore. The side of the seaplane's fuselage was marked with large, festive-looking symbols, but few of those present could read them. Departure time for Friendship Flight, the first non-stop flight from pole to pole, said Cora. For the 15th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, Mom flew Dad's new ambassador to the north non-stop up to Cinerioch, partly as a gesture of reconciliation and partly just to prove it could be done. She pointed to the tall man. That's Ambassador Piuvik, looking like he's trying not to run away. Wasn't a big fan of flying, poor man. And Xu Li, of course. Her company built the plane. There was a civil war between the water tribes? Utina wondered. Yeah, said Cora. Long time ago. It was basically the second thing I ever had to deal with as Avatar. I know, right? She said with a laugh to Utina's surprised look. Most people get easy jobs their first year or so at work. Me? I got a fascist conspiracy slash terrorist uprising in Republic City, then a civil war in the South Pole. Oh, and when you're done with that, there's this ongoing attempt to destroy the world we'd like you to see if you could do anything about. After which it would be really excellent if you could take a look at the worldwide spirit crisis. Don't forget to get your parking validated. The deep end's the best place to start anyway, said Utina mock casually, winking at Anthy, who giggled. Cora chuckled. Most of the time I'd agree with you, she said. At the time, though, I think I'd have preferred a slightly shallower learning curve. On the other hand, she went on with another sentimental smile as she selected the next image, having an uphill climb like that does make moments like this one even sweeter. The next picture was slightly faded, but still quite striking, seeing as it was a full-color photograph. Cora, Mako, Bolin, and Asami seated on a picnic blanket on a grassy rise, with the large shape of a polar bear dog serving as their backrest. Apparently taken in the spring, the photo showed a ready camaraderie evident among the four, as they pointed down towards the water, where a much smaller white shape was seen splashing, trying to catch some fleeing turtle ducks. "Is that the island in the park?" Caitlin asked, indicating the stone lantern in the right of the photo. "Good eye. Yep, it is. One of Ati's first trips out. That's her, terrorizing the turtle ducks." Cora smiled fondly at the scene. "Couldn't wait to get off the island and into the field. That's why she was called Ati. It means, well, you can translate it a lot of different ways, but basically it means, come on, hurry up, let's go, that kind of thing." "Huh. I just noticed this isn't tinted like the one of you and Asami in the Earth Kingdom. It's an actual color photo," said Utena. "Yeah, personal color photography lagged behind commercial color printing for a while. Only the big mover studios and corporations could afford developing and distributing color prints. But once they got the processing time and costs down, then all the papers and magazines were doing it." Cora shuffled through several more photos before stopping at what looked to be a full-page picture from a sports magazine. "Case in point, this picture here." This one was also in broad daylight, centered on a grinning Asami and Cora, clad in matching Future Industries racing leathers, surrounded by a crowd of cheering people. Sprays of foam filled the image as Cora hoisted some sort of wine bottle aloft to splash it over a grinning Asami's head. By popular demand, Asami and me on the podium after winning the first Future City Historic Grand Prix, Cora commented dryly. Seriously, the fanzines were reading way too much into it. I've seen worse at Minami and Ryo's races, for that matter. Minami and Ryo raised matching eyebrows at Cora. "Still, I mean, see what you're doing with the foam there?" Corwin pointed out. Kate looked and smiled. "Nope, can't imagine why anyone would read into that." "Not in any way," Utena agreed. "She looks like she's enjoying it, though," Anthy pointed out. "It's a deliberately misleading frame choice," Cora protested. "I'm just raising the bottle up so that I can pour it over her head. They picked this one on purpose." Kate nodded. "Mm-hmm." Then, sitting back, she mused aloud, "Memo to self. Get Jury into a winner's circle as soon as possible." "Moving on," said Cora briskly.